You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Inner Nature of Man and the Life Between Death and a New Birth. This is Lecture 3, given in Vienna on the 11th of April, 1914. In this lecture, we shall have to draw attention to several positive results of occult investigation, which will enable us to penetrate into the nature of man, and will also show us what a complicated being man really is as he exists in the world. Can we think otherwise than that this human being must be a very complicated being, when we reflect how the true ideal of man, that which it is possible for man to become if he really develops all the possibilities contained within him, is fundamentally the content of the religion of the gods, and that all the spiritual beings belonging to the various hierarchies, whom we know to be connected with human nature, really work together with one object, that of building up man out of the whole cosmos, as the purport of that cosmos. The first thing we remark is that when a human being receives impressions of the outer world, he actually receives into his consciousness only a small portion of what really surges in upon him. When in the physical world he opens his sense organs and the intellect connected with his brain and nervous system, when he considers the world and tries to explain what comes to him in this way, only a small portion of what surges in upon him really attains the form of ideas. Only a tiny portion really enters the consciousness of man. Light and color contain much more than what enters man's consciousness. In sound there is much more than what comes into the consciousness of man. External materialistic physics, in its childish idea of the world, says that behind color, behind light, etc., there are material processes, vibrations of atoms, and so on. This is indeed but a childish conception of the world, for in reality the following comes to light. We must investigate human perception with clairvoyant vision, for only by observing the actual process of perception can we understand man's relation to the surrounding world, even though we consider only the physical world. Something quite unique appears when we observe the process of perception clairvoyantly. Let us suppose some object affects our eyes. We perceive light or color, and thus we have in our consciousness the sensation of light or color. The remarkable fact one discovers through spiritual investigation is that in the human being there appears not only this light and this color, but in consequence of light and color, there appears what we might call a sort of light corpse or color corpse. Our eyes cause us to have the sensation of light and color. Thus, we might say, the light streams toward us and brings about in us the sensation of light. But looking deeper into our being, we discover that while we are conscious of light, our human nature is permeated by something that has to die in us in order that we may have the sensation of light. We can have no perception, no sensation from outside, without a sort of corpse being formed as the result of this sensation. The spiritual investigator has to say, quote, here I see a human being. I know that he has the sensation of red. But I see that this red, which is in his consciousness, pours forth something, pervades his whole being with something which, insofar as it has entered within his skin and the limits of his etheric body, kills something in him which becomes like the corpse of the color. Imagine that whenever We confront the physical world and have our sense organs open. We always receive into us the corpses of all our sensations, as phantoms, but active phantoms. Whenever we perceive the outer world, something dies in us. This is a most remarkable phenomenon. And the spiritual investigator has to ask, what happens here? What is the cause of this very remarkable phenomenon? One has to consider what it really is that comes to us as light. This light is a great deal behind it. What manifests as light is only the forerunner, as it were, of that which surges in upon us. At any rate, there is not behind the light that undulating motion which external physics fancies, but behind the light, behind all sensations, behind all impressions, there is that which we only comprehend when we view the world occultly, through imaginations, through creative images. The moment we perceive all that lives in light, in sound, or in warmth, we perceive, behind what reaches our consciousness, creative imagination. And within this again is revealed inspiration, and within that, intuition. That which comes into our consciousness as the sensation of light or sound is but the outermost layer, only the froth, as it were, of what comes to us. But within it there is that which, as it, if it were to enter our consciousness, could become in us imagination, inspiration, and intuition. In what we perceive, we really only receive one-fourth of that which assails us. The other three-fourths penetrate into us without our being aware of them. When we perceive color, there presses into us, as it were, below the surface of the sensation of color, creative imagination, inspiration, and intuition. These sink into us. When we investigate more closely into that which thus enters into us, we find that if imagination, inspiration, and intuition were really to enter our organism as they wish to do through sense perception, the result would be that even during the period of our physical earthly existence, between birth and death, they would bring about the same spiritual effect, as I mentioned yesterday, as a possible result of the temptation of Lucifer. This imagination, inspiration, and intuition would so act upon us that we should have the impulse to cast behind us every possibility that exists for our becoming the ideal man in the far distant future. And we should want to spiritualize ourselves as we are now. We should want to become spiritual beings at the stage of perfection we have now reached through our previous life. In a certain sense, we should say to ourselves, quote, it would be too great an effort for us to become man, for to reach this goal, we should have to tread a difficult path in the future. We shall forego the possibilities yet lying in man. We prefer to become angels with all our imperfections, for then we can rise at once into the spiritual world. We can then spiritualize our being. We shall, however, be less perfect than we might be in the cosmos, in view of our possibilities. But still, we shall be spiritual, angelic beings. Close quote. Here again you see, from this example, the great importance of what is called the threshold of the spiritual world, and how important the being is who is called the guardian of the threshold. For there he stands, at the point of which I have just spoken. It is he who only allows sensation to enter our consciousness, and does not allow imagination, inspiration, and intuition to enter. For if these were to enter, they would rouse within us a direct impulse to spiritualize ourselves just as we are, foregoing all the subsequent life of humanity. This has to be veiled from us. The door of our consciousness is closed against this impulse which penetrates our being. And insofar as it penetrates our being, without our being able to illuminate it with the light of consciousness, as we are obliged to let it descend into the dark depths of our subconsciousness, there comes toward it those spiritual beings to whom Lucifer is opposed. These come into our being from the other side, and now arises within us the war between Lucifer, who sends in his imagination, inspiration, and intuition, and the spiritual beings to whom Lucifer is opposed. With every sensation, with every perception, we should behold this battle, if the threshold of the spiritual world were not closed to our outward perception. But to clairvoyant vision, it is not closed. From this you may see what a great deal really takes place in the inner part of human nature, and the result in us of the battle which takes place there is what I have described as a sort of corpse, a partial corpse. This corpse is the expression of that which has to become entirely material in us. It is like a mineral deposit, which we are unable to spiritualize. If this corpse were not formed through the war between Lucifer and his opponents, we should have, instead of this corpse, the result of imagination, inspiration, and intuition within us, and we should rise at once into the spiritual world. The corpse forms the dead weight by which the good spiritual beings, the opponents of Lucifer, detain us at first in the physical world. Detain us in it, so that because of this veiling, we should strive toward the true ideal of human nature, and the fulfillment of all the possibilities that may be ours. Through this content, this corpse phantom being formed in us, through our receiving into ourselves every time we perceive something which is at the same time a corpse, we kill in us during the act of perception this ever-springing impulse toward spiritualization. It is while this deposit is forming that what I have often mentioned occurs, and of which it is so important we should recognize the full significance. Just consider. When you look into a mirror, you have a sheet of glass before you. This you would see through if it were not for the mirroring substance spread on it. Through the mirroring substance being upon the sheet of glass, everything that is in front of the mirror is reflected. If you were really to stand before your physical body in such a way that you experienced the perceptions which pass into it from imaginations, inspirations, and intuitions, you would then see through the physical body, and your feeling would be such that you would say, quote, "I will have nothing to do with this physical body. I will take no notice of it, but I will rise, just as I am, into the spiritual world." Close quote. The physical body would really stand before you like a pane of glass, without any mirroring substance behind it. But the physical body is now permeated with the corpse, which resembles the mirroring substance of the mirror, and it reflects everything that falls upon it, exactly as in the case of sense perception. It is in this way sense that perceptions originate. Let me read that again. It is in this way that sense perceptions originate. The permanent corpse we bear within us is the reflecting substance of our whole body, and we thereby see ourselves in the physical world. It is because of this that we are individual physical beings in the physical world. How complicated does the human being now appear to us? Let us take the other case, in which we not merely perceive, but we think. When we think, it is not a sense perception. Sense perceptions may give rise to thought, but true thought does not consist of sense perceptions. It is a more interior process. When we think, we make no impression in our physical body with the actual thought, but we do upon our etheric body. When we think, all that is in the thought does not enter into us. Were all that is contained in thought to enter into us, we should feel every time we think nothing but living elemental beings pulsing in us. We should feel inwardly alive. I mentioned once at Munich that if a person were to experience thoughts just as they are, he would feel somewhat as if he were in an ant heap. Thoughts would live in him, everything would be alive. We do not perceive this life in our human thought, because again only what is like the froth of it enters our consciousness and forms those shadow pictures of thought which appear in us as our thinking. On the other hand, that which permeates thought as living force sinks into our etheric body. We do not perceive the living beings, the living elemental beings swarming through us, but only an extract, something like a shadow of them. But the other part, the life, does enter into us, and as it enters into us, pervades us in such a manner that again a battle takes place, this time in our etheric body, between the progressing spirits and Ahriman, the Ahrimanic beings. And what is the outcome of this battle? It is that thoughts do not appear in us as they would do if they were alive. Were they to appear as they actually are, we should feel ourselves within the life of the thought beings moving hither and thither. But we do not perceive this, and our etheric body, which otherwise would be transparent, is rendered opaque. I might say that it becomes somewhat like a smoke topaz, which has darker layers in it, while quartz is quite transparent and pure. In the same way, our etheric body is filled with a spiritual obscurity, and that which thus fills our etheric body is the treasure of our thought. This treasure of thought arises through thoughts being reflected, as it were, in our etheric body in the way described, but in this case in quotes, time. They are reflected back as far as to the point of time to which our memory extends in physical life. Memory is reflected thoughts, thoughts reflected in time. But deep down, in our etheric body, behind memory, work the good divine spiritual beings to whom Ahriman is opposed, and there they create, they construct the forces which are able to reanimate what has died in the physical body as the result of the above described process. Thus, whereas in our physical body a corpse is produced, parenthesis, a corpse which has to be produced, because otherwise we should have the impulse to spiritualize ourselves with all the imperfections we possess, close parenthesis, something like an invigorating vital force proceeds from the etheric body, so that in the future that which has been killed can once more be regenerated. We now see for the first time the significance of, in quotes, before and, in quotes, afterward. If in the immediate present we were fully, to experience the intuitions, inspirations, etc., which enter into us. We should spiritualize ourselves, but through their being thrown into the future by Ahriman, through their not being used now, but being preserved as germs for the future, they attain at last to their true nature. That which we should misuse at the present time, we shall employ in the future, when we have passed the portal of death, to shape a new life for ourselves from out the spiritual world. That which, if we were to use it in the physical world, would lead us to spiritualize ourselves with all our imperfections, is the force that leads us after death to apply ourselves again to physical earthly life. In such opposite directions do things work in different worlds. Such is the case with respect to our thought. And now, let us consider feeling, that which we have within us as inner feeling. That which we perceive as inner feeling is, once more, not really what it could be according to its whole inner nature. What we have within us as feeling, what enters our consciousness as feeling, is only the shadow of what really lives within us. For, here again, in our feeling, spiritual beings live. Remembering what I said in the first lecture, you will perceive that in feeling live the spiritual beings who are really at the back of the whole of our planetary system, only they do not enter our consciousness. Feeling, as we know it, enters our consciousness. The rest remains outside our consciousness. What does it really mean when we say that the rest remains outside our consciousness? It is really very difficult to find words in ordinary language which exactly describe these things. Just as we must say perception and thought produce within us something that is really like a killing, but in the case of thought, through counteraction, there is at the same time a sort of impulse toward a future, quote, making alive, close quote. So, also, we have to say that every feeling we have is not really born in us. It does not come fully into existence. If everything that is in us, when we feel, were to emerge, what is contained in the feeling would lay hold of and give force to that which is behind the feeling in quite a different manner. That which really makes feeling into a living being whose life is nourished by the entire planetary system, does not appear directly. Feeling does arise in us, but as a shadow of what it really is. The result is that, however profoundly a person may enter into his world of feeling, however deep his feeling for humanity, he is really aware of something unsatisfactory in respect of every feeling. He perceives that each feeling might be enhanced. It might come forth with more power, especially as regards feeling, we have something like a secret consciousness that it could reveal to us much more than it does. It hides something that lives in our inner being, something that is in the depths of our soul, and that is only half born. When we pass on to our will, to all that as wish and will can arise within us, the case is the same as with feeling, but to a higher degree. For behind the will is to be found the spiritual being, the causal being who really lives in the sun. In the will, there lives not merely that which lives in the planets, but that which lives in the sun itself, but hidden. The will is still less entirely born than is feeling. The will would permeate us very, very differently if all that is contained in it were really to manifest itself in our consciousness. Only the outermost surface of the will, only its most superficial part, is really expressed. The other remains hidden from us. Why does a whole world remain hidden from us in feeling and in will. It is because, if that which remains hidden from us were to be seen from the physical plane, we could not bear it. Seen from the physical plane, it would have such an appearance that we should want to ward it off. We should want to turn away from it. That which lives in feeling and in will and remains unborn is karma in process of development, evolving karma. Let us suppose, to choose a concrete example, that we have a hostile feeling toward someone. That which comes into our consciousness when we have this hostile feeling is but the ripple on the surface. Below, forces are active, which extend over the whole of our planetary system. But it is precisely that which remains hidden that says to us, "Through thy hostile feeling thou art implanting in thyself something that is imperfect. This thou must make good." The moment that were to appear, let me read that again, the moment that were to appear, which dwells below the surface, we should see before us the, in quotes, imagination of what karmically must balance this hostile feeling. In order to avoid the compensation, we should unite ourselves with Lucifer and Ahriman, because we should judge what we saw from the standpoint of the physical plane. On the physical plane, this is hidden from us. The guardian of the threshold hides it from us, because we can only judge the things which are unborn in our feelings and in our will when we live in the spiritual world between death and rebirth. There we will what otherwise we never should will. There we will that what corresponds to a hostile feeling shall really be corrected, because there we have a true interest in the contents of divine religion, in the perfect ideal of humanity, which would make of us perfect human beings. From this we know that what has come to pass through a hostile feeling must receive its equivalent compensation. It has to be held over till the future. Only after death may that appear which has remained unborn in our feeling and will. Thus, you see, I have presented to you four things connected with the human soul. That which remains unborn in our feeling lives in the astral body. That which remains unborn behind our will lives in the I. Again, when we receive impressions of the outer world, we receive into us at the same time something like a physical corpse, which is really the mirroring substance of our physical body. We also have within us a deposit resembling a beclouding of the etheric body. In our astral body, we have something which does not come to birth in the period between birth and death, and in our will, we also have something which is not born during this period. This fourfold possibility which a human being bears within him must be aroused in the period between death and rebirth. It lives within us as the kernel of our soul, just as surely as the seed for the following year lives in the plant. Thus we do not only speak of a soul seed in a general way, but we can even comprehend this soul seed in its fourfold nature. When we have a feeling which produces an inward uneasiness, when we are not in harmony with life, it is because a certain pressure is exercised upon the conscious part of our feelings by the unborn part of our feelings. How can this pressure be relieved? Now, this pressure is something to which every human being is continually exposed, for what I have just described, in so far as it relates to feeling and will, that is, to what is really our soul life, is that which brings us into inner disharmony. If there were true unison between that part of feeling and will which is born and that which remains below the threshold of consciousness, if the right relationship, the right harmony existed, we should live in this sense world as happy and useful human beings. Here lies the real reason for all inner dissatisfaction. If anyone is inwardly dissatisfied, it comes from the pressure of the subconscious part of his feeling and will. Now, to the explanation I have given, I must add that the nature of man has changed in the course of his evolution. What I have just described applies particularly to the present time, but it was not always thus. In ancient periods of human evolution, let us say in the ancient Persian, Egyptian, and Indian ages, it was different. Of course, man's perceptions arose in exactly the same manner, and imaginations, inspirations, and intuitions were contained in them. But in ancient times, these imaginations, inspirations, and intuitions were not so entirely without effect upon man as they are today. They did not kill so completely the inner physical part of man. They did not make such a dense mineral deposit. This was because in those ancient times, under certain conditions, when perceptions came from outside, something shot up out of feeling and will to meet it. If, for example, we go back to the Egyptian or the Babylonian civilization and observe human beings, then we find that they perceived quite differently. Of course, they confronted the outer sense world just as we do, but their bodies were so organized that the imaginations hidden within the sense perceptions had not only their destructive effect, but they entered with a certain life-giving power. Because they entered in this way, living way, they produced inwardly the reflection of that which now remains entirely hidden in the ego and astral body. The spiritual beings belonging to the sun and planetary system pressed out from within and reflected, as it were, that which was animated by the imagination. So that, to the people belonging to the ancient Egyptian and Babylonian civilizations, there were certain times when, on turning their gaze to the physical world, they did not only have physical perceptions as we have them, but life-endowed perceptions. The Egyptian knew that behind his perceptions there was something which expressed itself in imaginations. Hence he was not so foolish as to suppose that behind the perceptions there were vibrations of material atoms, as our present physicists do. But he knew that there was life behind them, and from his inner being there streamed toward him pictures of the animated starry heavens and the living sun. This was particularly strong during the Persian culture, when, together with the outer perception, something like the inner spiritual force of the sun shone forth, Ahura Mazda. If we go back to still more ancient times, we find this interaction, this meeting of the inner and the outer, expressed very much more strongly. Today this can no longer be the case, but there can be a substitute. And here we reach a point where from the very nature of the thing, we can really understand the task of the anthroposophical conception of the world. A substitute has to be produced. We confront the outer world with our perceptions. We think about it. A part of this outer world remains hidden from us. And this has a deadening and darkening effect upon us. But through spiritual science, we can restore that which is thus darkened and deadened. It is precisely through the restoration of what otherwise is killed and darkened, that the science originates which portrays evolution through the Saturn, Sun, and Moon periods, as described in my book titled Occult Science. Every human being possesses this knowledge regarding the evolutions of Saturn, Sun, and Moon, only it is in the background of his consciousness. He would prefer not to be an earthly man were he able to see it directly, without the necessary preparation. He would prefer not to have any connections with the earth and to end with the moon evolution. All the knowledge we are able to acquire through spiritual science illuminates the hidden part of evolution in the past. That which, as imaginations, inspirations, and intuitions, lives outside and does not consciously enter into us, is really what we have gone through in the past to gain this knowledge, we must pass beyond the veil of sense perception. It is somewhat different regarding what is contained in our feeling and will. A person may say, and many have the impulse to say this at the present time, quote, "Why should I concern myself with what these odd people think out or have thought out regarding a supersensible world? I do not accept such ideas." Close quote. A person who says this has never formed any idea as to why religions have come into our evolution. The one thing which all religions have in common is that they relate to things we cannot perceive with our senses. The person who accepts religious ideas fills himself with something he cannot perceive with his senses. Ideas which come from what we sensibly perceive never give such an impulse to our feelings and will as may have an uplifting power after death. In order that the unborn part of our feeling and will may continue to be active after death, as indeed it must, we do not use ideas gained through the perception of the senses or through the intellect attached to the brain. These do not help us at all. The only ideas which give us the impulse and power which we need after death are the ideas which correspond to that which is not outwardly real. The conceptions which then accepted make us pious, and by which we look up to a spiritual world. Religious conceptions are those which cannot work in us as yet, but they become active forces after death. When we acquire religious conceptions, we are not merely acquiring knowledge, but something that can become active after our death. For this reason, it must be that anyone who does not want to reflect upon active forces of such a nature may laugh about them, and in his materialism may reject them. But if he does not acquire ideas regarding what is supersensible, he will have but crippled powers wherewith to develop that which has remained unborn in his feeling and will. Therefore, it must frequently be stated that light is thrown on the past by clairvoyant consciousness. This is recognized at the present time in so far as it exists behind the veil of the sense world as imagination, inspiration, and intuition. In former times, this consciousness was given to man as a religious belief, in order that he might not lose all uplifting power for the period after death, and that he might have something in his soul like a seed that could carry on the life of the soul even when he had laid aside the physical body. The time has now come when mankind ought to acquire ideas about the supersensible worlds through the understanding of spiritual science. For this reason, it cannot be too often stated that the spiritual investigator alone can investigate these matters in the supersensible world. But when they have been investigated and then imparted to us, there is something in our inmost soul which is a hidden language of the soul, which can grasp and understand the discoveries made by the spiritual investigator. It is only when the prejudices of the mind and senses hold sway that the supersensible ideas, furnished us by spiritual research, are looked upon as nonsense, as foolishness and fantasy. Ideas which, when accepted, endow the soul with an uplifting power, which enables it to find its way in the cosmos through all the ages to come. It will always be the case that only those who have gone through an esoteric development will be able to investigate the contents of the spiritual world. But to know these contents, to work upon them inwardly in the consciousness, to hold them as ideas and conceptions, to possess the spiritual world as a certainty of the soul's existence, is something that humanity will have need of more and more as its necessary spiritual food. It is this which shows us how, from its very nature, the mission of our anthroposophical movement can be understood. In ancient times, it still was the case that knowledge was animated from above, and the capacity for receiving this knowledge came from below. Hence, the ancients still possessed a direct consciousness of the spiritual worlds, but this consciousness gradually became dim and dark. Had this not come to pass, man would not have arrived at the full consciousness of the ego. He can only attain to full consciousness of his ego by developing to the highest degree in his physical body the phantom corpse of which I have spoken. Our physical body as a transparent being must be, as it were, entirely overlaid with, quote, mirror foil, close quote. And only when it is completely overlaid are we so conscious of ourselves that we can say, quote, I am an I, close quote. But the complete overlaying has only been done slowly and gradually, for it has developed in the course of the evolution of humanity. It was completed in the age in which the mystery of Golgotha took place. The application of the mirror foil was then completed. Before that time, the higher and the lower natures of man still met. What was below and what was above in a human being came together. One may say that through the covering of mirror foil being perfected, the higher and the lower were completely forced apart, and this only came about when the event of Golgotha drew near. What had then really taken place? Let us look more closely at what had taken place. Picture to yourselves the consciousness of these ancient people before the mystery of Golgotha. From outside comes the life-giving force of imaginations. From within arise pictures of the superhuman spiritual world. What are these pictures which thus arise in the human being? As we know, this was possible in ancient times, owing to the clouded condition of human consciousness. Those who knew these things, those who, as initiates, were able to see the human soul, and who saw it in this meeting of the life-giving imagination from without and the vision from within, these did not say, quote, man alone sees this, close quote, but these ancient initiates, the ancient Jewish initiates, for example, said, quote, Yahweh or Jehovah looks upon his world in man. God thinks in man. Close quote. Just as at the present time, in our cycle of evolution, when we have a thought, we may say, quote, I think, close quote. Those who knew these things in ancient times said when the pictures from the spirit worlds appeared to them, quote, the gods are thinking in us, close quote. Or as they recognized the unity of divinity in monotheism, they said, quote, Jehovah thinks in man. Man is the stage whereon the play of divine thoughts is carried out, close quote. Men felt themselves inflamed by these thoughts. Therefore they said, quote, in me the gods think, close quote. But the necessity arose in human evolution that this should become more and more impossible, and that darkness should spread more and more. The possibility of seeing visions, the thoughts of the gods in man, ceased. The phantom-like corpse in man became more and more pronounced. The time drew near when no more thoughts came forth from out human nature to meet the gods. The divine being, regarding whom it was said that he thought through man, felt his consciousness becoming dimmer and dimmer, for his consciousness consisted in his thoughts. And the longing arose within this divine being to awaken a new form of consciousness. When men acquire a different form of consciousness, they acquire something of the utmost importance. When the gods create a new form of consciousness, they create with it something essential, something of the most profound moment occurs. The thing of profound importance that now came into being was the Christ. Christ, the child of the Godhead, restored to man the power whereby he was conscious of God. restored the consciousness which the previously mentioned divine being had felt to be darkened. To accomplish this, the Christ had to enter into and become a part of human nature. We must become fully aware of the fact that in the act of perceiving the sense world, we receive continually into ourselves the content of death. That when we think about this world, we are receiving obscuration and darkness into ourselves. And when we feel and will, something remains unborn in us. All these remain below in the depths of our consciousness, and with them there enters into us the content of something dead and something unborn, which we can only first make use of after we are dead. But the power to do this would be crippled if we could not let it sink into the being whom the Godhead has brought to birth as the principle of the new consciousness, if we could not let it flow into the Christ being. When through spiritual science we really recognize the meaning of evolution, we become conscious of the following. We realize that we send down into the subconscious depths of our being that which dies in us. But the death which we send down more and more into our own being is received by the Christ, who comes to meet us with life-giving power. Christ gives life to that which dies in us, which darkens in us, which remains unborn in us. We allow that to die in us, which must die in order that we may approach the true ideal of humanity with all the possibilities it contains. But the death content which streams into us, we pour into the Christ being, for he has pervaded human evolution since the founding of Christianity. And we also realize that what remains unborn in us, our feeling and will, is received by the Christ substance into whom it will sink after death. For within us dwells the Christ, ever since he passed through the mystery of Golgotha. Into Christ we let sink the death content which is present with every perception. Into him we allow the darkening of our power of thought to sink. Into the light, into the spiritual sunlight of Christ, we send our darkened thoughts. And when we pass through the portal of death, our unborn feeling sinks within the substance of Christ, and so too does our unborn will. When we understand evolution aright, we say to this evolution, in Christ we die. In Christo morimus. The end of Lecture 3.